And that is the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Hello, you guys.
Hello.
Glenn Weldon, why don't you tell me what you do for NPR?
I write about books and comics for the NPR website.
Trey Graham, what do you do for NPR?
I'm the movies editor for NPR.org, and I'm the guy who wiggles in his chair just a little bit when you say kicky.
Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I sit stock still while you say kicky, and I am an editor at NPR Music.
Fantastic. Well, we're happy that all of you are here. And the first thing that we want to talk about today is that Stephen and I were heroically, I would say.
American heroes.
We spent our Sunday night live blogging the Grammy Awards. And so if any of you want to know what happened on the Grammy Awards and witness our gradual descent into madness, where by the end we're just basically talking about how much we want to go to bed.
It is true.
I encourage you to check out the Grammy Awards live blog, which we will link to, but which you can find at Monkey See. At any rate, Stephen, what was your favorite moment of the Grammys?
Oh, I mean, there's no way I can't say the end.
The end.
The part, not necessarily the part where Arcade Fire won Album of the Year, but the part where I got to stop live blogging.
You were going to say the part where Arcade Fire got the Album of the Year award and completely blew all of your predictions out of the water.
No, actually, Esperanza Spalding blew all my predictions out of the water and also broke the internet.
Yes.
Yes.
Pretty much did.
She certainly did. Esperanza Spalding, as some of you may know, is a jazz musician who won Best New Artist over a kid you might have heard of.
I hadn't heard of him.
Who has a few fans on the internet. Mm-hmm. They call him Justin Bieber.
Yes.
Bieber.
I've heard. And Bieber. I would have to say my favorite moment was probably CeeLo.
I was going to say.
CeeLo in the
performance-wise.
Doing his Elton John Muppet Show, whatever that was, with Gwyneth Paltrow.
There's a combination that, you know, you don't really ever expect to see, right?
Well,
aside from the fact that it had been announced.
Gwyneth Paltrow is one of those bizarre characters where I feel like she's completely predictable, and yet from time to time she does something that I have not predicted. So it's very odd in that way. But, you know, it was a perfectly acceptable performance.
I mean,
Grammys.
I would have preferred that Gwyneth Paltrow be dressed similarly to CeeLo, who, it should be noted for those who didn't see it, was wearing Elmo and a breastplate.
Right.
And
like a comic book character.
A sort of mirrored shower cap.
Yes.
And gigantic Elton John sunglasses.
And a feathered head piece.
And a gigantic sort of feather headdress.
If you've ever seen, this is the kind of thing that really is only helpful if you grew up in or around Philadelphia, but if you've ever seen Mummers Parade, which is a sort of famous Philadelphia New Year's event involving these string bands who wear these giant feathered... Glenn is cringing.
I'm having a brown acid flashback.
Glenn is familiar with the Mummers Parade, but it is this parade involving these gigantic feathered costumes and headpieces and people playing banjos. So, well, it is.
It is. It's just feathers and banjos.
It just sounds funny
when
you say it.
The Mummers are kind of like, you know, the love children of carnival showgirls and the guys from Deliverance.
Sort of, yes. And so CeeLo looked to me like the most unexpected mummer at the Grammy Awards.
Mm. Oh, that was so great. There was a bunch of enormously entertaining live performances, which I have to say, as much as I enjoy them, they're the hardest thing to live blog.
They are. Mm.
When there's some bat crap lunacy going on, it's as much as that was lunatic, it was also musically enjoyable.
And right.
I sort of count on the Grammys to provide me with a little bit more mockery.
And some of the performances were good. There was the Mumford & Sons and Avett Brothers and Bob Dylan thing, which Bob Dylan is in odd voice these days. But other than that... Bob Dylan is in odder voice these days.
Right.
But I still think that was a good showing for those two bands. Like, well, seeing those two bands kind of just do the thing that they do where they're super excited about playing.
Yeah, it's enormously satisfying to see the best-looking bands in that genre rewarded.
Boy, they really are.
I have a question for both Stephen and Mike. When Arcade Fire won, my Twitter feed lit up not with praise for Arcade Fire, but fulsome love for Merge Records. Their label.
Yeah.
And speaking as somebody who sees music from a artist perspective and not a label perspective, I don't see labels.
You're above it all.
I'm above it all. That struck me as odd to me. And I just want to, I've done some research since then to kind of figure out why this love exists.
Right.
But could you guys talk about that a little bit?
I don't want to put Mike in front of a microphone if we can avoid it.
Okay.
So I'll take this one.
Good then.
I think that, first of all, the Arcade Fire winning album of the year, as much of a surprise as it was, and as much as a lot of other people like that band, there's a little bit of a sense that, well, that's not the album I would have given Arcade Fire album of the year for. I think it's pretty clearly the least of their albums. But those of us who not only have dealt with Merge Records professionally, but who love a lot of other bands on that label and reliably look for the Merge label.
Who else is on that label?
Okay. Well, one of my favorite bands right now, Y-Oak, is on that label. Superchunk owns that label, and a lot of us have sort of a long-running appreciation for and respect for and love for Superchunk.
Lamb Chop. Magnetic Fields.
Magnetic Fields. Mm-hmm. Neutral Milk Hotel. They're sort of continuing to churn out records that I really, really like and enjoy. And as we have this conversation, I'll occasionally be like, oh, I gotta mention so-and-so.
Right. These are bands I like, but what I'm asking is, it just doesn't occur to me to go to the label. I guess it's kind of like with books. If you have a small publisher that's sort of indie, like Ad House or First Second or Algonquin, and they get a big book, you're happy for the press. Is that the same deal?
Right. And imagine if Fantagraphics won the, you know, I don't know what awards they give out.
There's the Harvey, there's the Eisner.
If they won the Newbery Award or the...
Oh. Nice.
If a publishing house where you not only was sort of a mark of quality that put out a lot of your favorite books and was staffed and owned by people you like and respect personally, and I really, really respect their aesthetic and the way that they treat artists. There are artists on that label who could easily have signed, you know, at least on the surface, lucrative deals and gotten much more exposure had they not stuck with Merge Records but stayed with Merge Records because they like it. And that label is in a sea of, let's say, a troubled music industry, is a real success story. And I think that they're a success story in large part because they do so many things in what I would consider the right way. And so I was enormously happy for Merge Records.
I think NPR had a big story about Merge Records maybe a year ago.
Well, there was a book.
It's from Algonquin Press, as a matter of fact. It's called,
we'll try to dig that up.
It's called Our Noise, the Story of Merge Records. And I ordered it because I like all these bands. It just never occurred to me to kind of look past the band. To the
thought that was a really interesting phenomenon, too. I had the same reaction. Yeah. I was like, who ever heard of being this excited about the label as opposed to the band? I heard the same thing.
I heard a lot of discussion leading up to the Grammys about how half the nominees are on independent labels and isn't that great. But if you actually scoured the major nominations, there were very few actual little guys. There were sort of little guys where they're actually sort of quote-unquote independent offshoots of major labels and have major label distribution and are really independents in name only. And you have actual Merge Records. And in the case of Esperanza Spalding, you have Tiny Little Heads Up Recordings, which is, you know, which is a true independent label as well. And so, you know, when you see actual independently run labels rewarded in such a way, and you actually like the artists and you like the people who run those labels, it is exciting. And when you've sat through 3.5 hours of an awards ceremony out of obligation, and something happens that makes people you like enormously happy and will, you know, feed future art that you like.
That's
the question I sort of wanted to turn to now, is the Grammys take a lot of mockery in the run-up and in the execution. And I sort of wondered how those two awards and maybe, you know, a couple of others, if there were any others that excited you, did you feel any different about the Grammys at the end of the show because of these things?
Well, it's funny that you should ask, because I was just thinking about this, that in the run-up to the Grammys and in the run-up to every Grammys, there is this sort of like, oh God, the Grammys, you know, and everybody feels obligated to cover, and how are we going to cover the stupid Grammys? And you're watching the ceremony, and you're like, eh, this is so commercial. Oh, they gave Milli Vanilli a Grammy. Oh, the Grammys are so stupid. And then, oh my God, this thing that I love won! And all of a sudden, the Grammys, when they are actually validating something you like, are very meaningful.
Right.
It's a funny phenomenon with awards shows in general, where you can think they're the stupidest charade in the world until they like something you like, at which point you beam with pride.
If it provides the artist with a small amount of recognition, especially for somebody who isn't especially famous, like with Esperanza Spalding, you know, you had all these articles the next day that were sort of saying, here's who this person is, who you perhaps have never heard of.
Right.
You know, Esperanza Spalding was not familiar necessarily to a lot of people who watch the Grammys, but certainly has taken on some relatively high-profile assignments. She's played for President Obama and, family multiple times.
She played at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. She's certainly, you know, among those in the jazz world. She's extremely well-known and gets a lot of work that way.
Right.
One thing that I wanted to bring up, sort of along the lines of what we're talking about, is I remember Felix Contreras, who is co-host of another podcast that you should also be subscribing to called Alt Latino. Felix made a really great point to people who were sort of sneering about them, where he said, you have to keep in mind that for a lot of these categories, this is actually very, very powerful and important,
mm-hmm.
winning a Grammy, being able to say, you know, if you win Best Latin Jazz Album and you win that Grammy, that is enormously helpful if you're trying to get gigs, if you're trying to get, you know, get attention, if you're trying to get your record in stores. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as easy as it is to sneer at the, what did they give out, 10 trophies?
Mm-hmm.
On the broadcast.
On the broadcast. Yeah. To sneer at those, or to sneer at the 8 that didn't go to Arcade Fire or Esperanza Spalding, you know, you may say, well, what does it matter if Eminem, you know, one Best Rap Album, got up and looked as if he'd just been kicked in the shins.
He did.
The entire time he was accepting an award. You know, you can say, well, it doesn't matter to Eminem, it doesn't matter to me, it doesn't matter to how well that record sells. But the people who won, you know, the other 99 Grammys that were given out, a lot of those will actually greatly help those artists.
Yeah, I'm just guessing if you're a classical performer, you know, with a recording of something that's been recorded a gajillion times.
Sure.
You know, that helps you get in front of people.
Sure.
One other thing about Esperanza Spalding winning Best New Artist, Justin Bieber, if anything, probably benefits from not winning Best New Artist. You know, at some point, the fervor of his fan base is going to cool off a little bit. And this definitely reignites.
Right.
You know, if Justin Bieber seems like somebody who has to be defended, that is going to only help his case. And the flip side is that, obviously, I mean, Esperanza Spalding benefits so much more from winning that Grammy in primetime and having all this discussion about her than Justin Bieber would have had he won.
Yeah.
If anything, they're both better off.
Well, great. So that's the Grammys, and you can check out the live blog on Monkey See, and we'll link to that, as I said.
Because I know that you know, many people were saying to me, Stephen, how can I relive the Grammy ceremony?
Yeah.
Hey, no. So our next topic, we have heard from many of you on our Facebook page that you were interested in hearing us talk a little bit about video games. So this past weekend, we had an outing. We had a little podcast outing.
A field trip.
We had a little field trip over to Glenn Weldon's house.
Yes, we did.
And
we did.
At Glenn Weldon's house, we played video games.
We did.
Why don't you...
Be jealous, people.
I have to say, this is the most tastefully appointed game room I've ever been in.
It really was.
Ridiculous.
It's a very, very pretty room, as you can all, as you would all believe, knowing what a classy guy.
Pretty in a manly way.
I just want to say
pretty
that
in a manly way.
Short of the...
Muscular.
Short of the pop culture museum, the Jeppy Museum in Baltimore, which I highly recommend people check out. Short of the Jeppy Museum, I have never seen a more tastefully appointed place with that much Aquaman paraphernalia.
See?
That
it can
true.
Be done.
There
can
is
be done.
There is a shrine.
Yeah.
There is a shrine. So, Glenn, why don't you run down some of the games that you had us play?
Sure. We started off with Tekken, which is a fighting game. Actually, it's Tekken 6. And
The first five were so satisfying.
As a matter of fact, it kind of were.
Oh, my God.
But, so everybody kind of beat up on each other. You know, when Faust and I first got Tekken 3 back in the day, 1999, we played that game over and over and over again. And it got so that after a long week at work, we would come home, open a bottle of wine, and say to each other, "Do you want to play couples therapy?" And open up a can of whoop-ass on each other.
I have to say, it was awesome. I was really taken aback by the sheer bloodlust that erupted into the room.
Really? You were?
The pink ponytailed bloodlust.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It was.
You guys totally wailed on each other. It was great.
Were you the panda?
I was the panda.
You were the panda.
I was naturally the panda, given my love of Kung Fu Panda.
You were the panda when I was Big Bob.
I thought you were the schoolgirl when
I was
the panda.
I was both.
There was some schoolgirl on panda violence, as
I recall. Well, no, it was schoolgirl on kangaroo.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
And the little Joey had boxing gloves, too, and didn't actually use them.
Yeah.
Seriously, if you have not played this game, you need to understand that the number of avatars that you can inhabit, well, there are many of them, and they are also exceptionally strange.
Yes, right. Of course.
And most of them are just big dudes with various headgear on. But then all of a sudden it'll be like, oh, or a kangaroo.
I tried many different avatars, all of which actually I found, it was amazing, whether they were kangaroos or pandas or giant dudes who looked like Kid and Play.
They got beat up.
They actually specialized in getting whaled on.
You were not having a good day in terms of getting the tar beaten out of you.
Now, again, you guys were just pressing buttons. You know, you didn't learn any of the moves. You didn't have time to learn any of the moves and the combos.
You didn't try the combination kicks that I had.
The thing that video games do is they kind of lull you into this false sense where you feel like you can do the thing you're making your character do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are dance games which make me kind of convinced that I know where the backbeat is. This is not true. With fighting games, I would always think, oh, I could probably do a flying dragon kick if it came to it.
Yeah. If cornered.
But I like the fighting.
It's a lot of fun. Just imagine what it's like to be there with your significant other and be like, "You didn't tell me your mom is coming to visit in 2 weeks. It's a one-bedroom apartment."
Especially if you're like landing when you get in the position where you kind of figuratively have basically me on the ropes,
and you're juggling. The term is juggling.
Okay, and you can just keep pummeling and pummeling and pummeling.
On the
one or two times that happened to me, for me, that was very satisfying.
Yep. So we did that, and then we played a game called Little Big Planet. In this game, you're a little dude who has to get through a level, and there's all kinds of obstacles, and you have to jump and leap and sometimes hold up a piece of the platform so that somebody else can go under it. And there's lots of...
Yeah, I don't like doing that.
It's basically a little bit like a Super Mario Brothers if it were a pain in the ass.
If you had to help people.
It's got a really good aesthetic, though. What was the lesson you learned from that, Stephen?
Well, it was interesting. I was recounting this day to my son because he is a great Wii enthusiast and has completed, you know, some incredibly complicated quest games that I can't even fathom. And I was trying to remember the name of that game, and I was trying to explain to him what it was like. And all I could come up with was the phrase, "baffling ordeal."
The game asks you to cooperate with another human being.
That's why.
To get through the level.
When Glenn and I played this game together, I've never actually seen Glenn pause to avoid yelling at me.
It's not true.
It is absolutely true. I saw the head go down.
So true.
I saw the moment when it was like, because I was having a lot of trouble. I believe it was a right versus left situation.
Yeah, no, your other left.
And it wasn't because I don't know the difference between my right and my left. It was that I wasn't hearing that people were saying, go to the left. I was concentrating on what
screaming.
Was... I was concentrating on what was in front of me. But I will say, very difficult. I found that game terribly, terribly difficult. And I said to Glenn, when I'm playing against someone and I'm fighting them, that's perfectly fine. And I can concentrate and I can just punch. But once I'm trying to cooperate with someone else and they're depending on me, I feel like there's all this pressure and I feel like I'm letting people down. And all of a sudden, there's all this emotional, there are all these issues of emotional intimacy that come into it.
It's emblematic of larger issues having little to do with the game.
So then we broke out the Wii, because we find that we only bring out the Wii when people are over. We never play it normally. We played a little You Don't Know Jack, if you recall.
You don't know Jack.
Oh, speaking of pressure not to look like a complete moron in front of your smarty pants podcast friends.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I won, and then Linda came from behind.
That's true. I came massively from behind in that game. You Don't Know Jack is a game that long, long ago, like I'm going to say 15 years, something like that, was a popular PC game in the era of CD-ROM games. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever played it, you know that you answer a bunch of questions, and then at the end, there's a round where they ask you to find things that match each other, and they float by, and you sort of have to leap quickly on the right answer as the answers are floating around the screen. And for some reason, this was my moment of power.
She was like a cat pouncing.
Okay. And I pounced, and so despite the fact that I got many other questions wrong, I managed to win the second game strictly by winning the Jack Attack round.
For those who've never seen You Don't Know Jack, it's set up like a game show. And and however many players, in this case there were four, can buzz in you know, as quickly as possible, just the way you would on a game show. And part of what I learned from this is that I should never go on a game show.
Right. Right.
With a buzzer.
With a buzzer, or with the need to answer questions correctly and in a timely fashion.
Right. Nice.
And hosted by a smart aleck announcer who will mock you mercilessly.
He will really mock you.
I knew the second it was like, yes, bears do have arms.
He will mock you. So what do we do next?
Well, then we finished up, I think, with, because, you know, by this time the beer and the wine had been flowing a little bit. It was time for Rayman Raving Rabbids,
which is a game that's,
you know, as old as the Wii is. So I apologize to hardcore gamers out there who are saying, you didn't play any, but it's an old game, I get it, but it's a lot of fun. And so there was one where you're just shooting plungers at rabbits, as you do. There's the game where you have to toss a cow. Mike did that with Verve and Elan.
He did. Mike was like the best cow
tossing.
He was really good at tossing cows.
For those who haven't actually seen Mike in person who are listening at home, he's kind of a svelte god. And seeing him,
the kicker would say in the movie The Replacements, he's whitey. He's whitey.
Oh, whitey. I thought you said whitey.
White. He's wiry.
Yes.
Yeah.
And finally, I think it was the dancing game where everybody kind of looked like a jerk.
Well,
there was the carrot juice shooting game.
Oh, I forgot about the carrot juice shooting game.
Yeah. So now this is my frustration. Mm. Basically, the dance game is the same as one of the few things that I have mastered on the Wii, which is Dancing with the Stars for the Wii. No laughing.
Sorry.
Hello.
What? I didn't. What?
Dancing with the Stars for the Wii is exactly like every other dancing game for the Wii, which is it requires you to move your arms in a certain rhythmic pattern, and I am good at it. I have mastered the mambo at the professional level. Hello. For some reason, this was basically the same game, and I was completely in the weeds. I think it was rigged.
Also, with this particular game, I found that I was terrible at it.
I will say, the day of video games partly made me think I should play more video games, but mostly made me think that I should hang out at Glenn's house.
Yes, this is a plan.
That I should hang out with my friends at Glenn's.
If you guys had to pick, I mean, I don't know, I think we're all sort of edge toward casual gamers non-gamers than hardcore gamers. If you had to pick one, what would it be?
Well, I was a very hardcore gamer in the 1980s when I was a teenager. Then I completely fall off. I just don't necessarily spend a lot of time playing video games, even though my kids really, really enjoy them. And I also, you know, highly recommend, of course, your Super Mario Brothers, which they managed to make enough like the game you played as a kid to work for kids and adults alike. Of the games we played, I really enjoyed your Raving Rabbids. Mm-hmm. And my kids have Rabbids Go Home, which is a sequel. And those are just fun. I think anything that are sort of a little bit more like party games.
Yeah.
We didn't play it, but I noticed that you had it, the Wario Smooth Moves.
It's a lot of fun.
I love that one.
Linda is a fan of that one as well. It's a lot of like little games that you don't necessarily have to learn how to play beyond shake the nunchuck like, as fast as you can. Or you know, the kind of goofball games that you can get really good at even if you're not typically good at knowing how to on all the cheat codes for finding the wizard's key.
Right.
I have to say, I have never been a hardcore gamer. I was, a casual arcade goer in the 80s. I was surprised to find out how much I really enjoyed Tekken.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have never thought of myself as the fight game guy. I enjoyed it so much that I left seriously thinking about buying a PS3.
Wow. Trey has some pent-up aggression.
Yep.
Who would have guessed?
We may hear from people who say, well, Mortal Kombat is better, or there's all kinds of other fighting games, but I like the Tekken.
I liked all of them. I think if I had all of you particular people there, I might play a lot of You Don't Know Jack, but that's just because I enjoy playing trivia games with
people I know. You enjoy my inferiority.
That is not.
Well, let me just say my favorite game of all time, and I think I'm closer to a hardcore gamer than anybody here, but that doesn't certainly mean anything. I certainly don't like shooters. I find them repetitive. I don't like going online to play games because I've said many times, if I want to be called a gay slur by a 9-year-old, I can do that for free by walking outside my door. I don't need that. Uh-huh. In 2003, for the original Xbox, a game came out called Beyond Good and Evil. It was a Nietzsche simulation. No, it wasn't a Nietzsche simulation. You go up to an abyss and just stare into it. Boring game. No. You played Jade, who is a photojournalist who defends her planet from an alien invasion and, of course, uncovers a sinister conspiracy that goes all the way to the top of government. So when my nephews asked me what, and I have teenage nephews, and they're thinking in terms of superlatives, right? They're saying, what's the best game you've played? What's the worst game you ever played? This is what I told them. I told them that what I like about this game is that it did all kinds of different things at once. There was combat, there were racing levels, there were Zelda-like dungeon puzzles, there was some platforming, but not really annoying platforming, and it looked fantastic, had great story, and was frequently very funny. That's what I told them. What I didn't tell them was that you earned extra points by taking photos of wildlife. But I also didn't tell them that the main character has short, spiky black hair, and she's rocking a headband and a kicky little jumpsuit, and she kind of looks like an Asian punk Joyce DeWitt. Didn't mention that.
Perfect.
But the thing about this game is, after being out of print for a long time, finally on March 2nd, it is being re-released for Xbox Live in HD. So I would recommend that game to just about anybody. It's a lot of fun.
How fantastic. Well, thanks, Glenn, for having us over. I think it's safe to say we enjoyed it.
As did I.
Oh, yeah.
Please feel free to chime in on our Facebook page or in the comments on the blog about your favorite video games.
Hey, how do you find our Facebook page, Linda?
You just search for Pop Culture Happy Hour, and you can find us on Facebook. Our next topic, we are going to kick out Stephen. And Stephen, let me explain. We're going to talk about the IFC sketch comedy show Portlandia. Stephen is pals with Carrie Brownstein, a former NPR blogger on the NPR Music blog, Monitor
still
an Mix.
Still an occasional NPR
Still an occasional
blogger.
NPR blogger and former regular and I would say now occasional participant in the All Songs Considered podcast.
One of the reasons that we thought to do this show is because All Songs Considered did these fun roundtable discussions
right.
in which Bob Boylan, Robin Hilton, Carrie Brownstein, and I would talk about music.
Right. And Carrie is one of the two stars of Portlandia. And since Stephen and Carrie are pals, we thought that we would kick out Stephen from the conversation. And we are going to, as we have been known to do in the past, I feel like we need special music for this.
Yeah.
Deploy the emergency catsup. Mike Gatziff, welcome to Pop Culture Happy
Hey,
Hour.
Hey, thank you.
On
hey.
The mic. And Mike, you're a fan of Portlandia.
Huge fan.
And why don't you explain a little bit about what the show is?
Portlandia is a series on IFC, which stars Fred Armisen. Most people will know from SNL, Saturday Night Live.
Is there Obama?
And Carrie Brownstein, as we said. And it's sort of a spinoff of a series of sketches they used to do called Thunder Ant, which was a series of web videos that they did. And actually, many of the same characters will appear on Portlandia. Portlandia, for the most part, is a sketch comedy show, sort of...
Well, it's set in and around Portland, Oregon, right?
Right. And there's about as many insider references to the city. There's guest stars of people, you know, famous people from Portland. And it's sort of... lovingly skewers a lot of those different types of people.
Typical sort of Portland types.
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean, ostensibly it's making fun of Portland, but it's really making fun of a particular breed of smug, self-satisfied, locavore, hipster doofus.
Yeah, the freegans
fixie,
and
fixie
the...
biking, have
the
a body
and
modified.
The freegans and the bike people and the coffee shops mm-hmm. and the...
I mean, it could be Brooklyn,
store.
Too. I mean, there's... It's
the
not just Portland,
that's
but...
That's what I mean.
Well, that's
you know,
true. And I did live in Portland for a few years. Mm-hmm. And I will say there is definitely some truth to it. Portland at that time we referred to as similar to Seattle, but not yet as crowded. Because this was back in the... This was back in the mid-90s. So it was sort of after the big Seattle boom had happened, but there had not been a comparable Portland boom. So yeah. I definitely experienced some of the vegans and freegans and bears, oh my.
I was going to ask if you were a freegan.
I was not.
Is that why you always ask to barter my sandwich? Are you going to eat that?
I live cheaply, but not that cheaply. Uh-huh. So, Mike, what do you like about Portlandia?
I'm just a huge fan of sketch comedy in general. I grew up watching Conan O'Brien, watching Mr. Show, Upright Citizens Brigade, Kids in the Hall, things like that. So I'm sort of accustomed to this style of sketch comedy show as opposed to Saturday Night Live. There's sort of like an overarching feel and theme
The closest is probably Kids in the Hall, just for like its sense of place, the identity that the city of Portland itself is as much a character as these crazy, kooky people.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think it could go wrong in two different ways, right? It could either be so broad that it becomes kind of toothless, because to be fair, a lot of these jokes about women's bookstores and food co-ops have been made before.
Sure.
And it could also go wrong by being too gentle and too so then it becomes a victim of its own preciousness. You know, it's kind of just becomes just as precious as the things it's making fun of.
Absolutely.
But I think it threads the needle very well. I mean, it's sketch comedy. Sketch comedy is hit or miss. That's the nature of the beast.
Sure.
If I don't believe that it attains the heights of Kids in the Hall, which is my favorite thing pretty much ever, I do think that they know enough about sketch comedy to get off of the premise as quickly as possible. So, for example, there's that sketch in the premiere where they go into a restaurant and they talk to the server about the chicken they're about to eat.
Yes.
So here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great.
He looks like a happy little guy who runs around.
A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like... You know, palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
And you have a good relationship with this farm.
We do.
But it's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami.
Oh,
who's
goodness,
just
no.
Saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type. No.
Yeah. Tell you what, we're gonna go check it out if you don't mind. If you could just hold our seats.
Oh, now.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
We'll
just
want to
make sure.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
If that was an SNL sketch, there would be a catchphrase and the entire sketch would take place within that restaurant and there'd be a blackout and it would be very repetitious. But because they're on film, they have a little bit more freedom and they can take it, jump off of that premise and go someplace very weird. And that's what I really like about it.
Well, one thing just to jump off just on that one particular scene with the, restaurant goers, what makes that work for me is like the small moments. You know, a lot of things that I think Fred Armisen in particular gets bad rap on SNL because he has to play like these bigger things, these catchphrase-driven joke delivery systems where on Portlandia he is able to play like these tiny little behaviors, a little stutter here and there, or the way he inflects his face just a little bit or turn a phrase is able to get like these smaller moments that, overall the entire series does really well. It plays these small moments. It's able to sort of live in an almost realism, even though like there's these cartoonized versions of situations. It really blows up and escalates very quickly, but it's sort of grounded in a reality that something like SNL is not able to do.
There's a specificity to it. Specifically with Armisen, who fills the screen with a lot of these little filigree moments that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. In a sketch, if he's not talking, he's doing something. So I do spend more of my time, frankly, watching him than Carrie Brownstein. But yeah, I mean, there is a truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things that you can develop when you have a fairly limited set of characters in a very specific place and a central set of themes, right? This is harder to do on a show like Saturday Night Live, assuming they're even interested in doing it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we talked a little bit about getting out from under catchphrases like they had on Saturday Night Live, and it does certainly have its catchphrases. If you have heard anyone say in the last few weeks, put a bird on it, which IFC has worked very hard to market.
Today we're going to go to a store on Mississippi Avenue. Nothing has birds on it. But you know what we're going to do? We're going to put birds on things.
Spruce it up. Make it pretty.
Thank you.
Put a bird on it!
Putting a bird on this teapot.
It's a bird.
I bet you it's flying all over the beach.
What a sad little tote bag. I know. I'll put a bird on it. Did you see this bag before? I didn't. Now there's a bird. It's flying. It's free.
What I liked about that joke when I saw that sketch is that, as you were saying, there is a specificity to it. It's a joke that has been done in a way, but if you go sort of wandering in the little shopping areas of places like Portland and similar areas, you do find those little things where everything is decorated with various little twee decorations. And I liked that detail because that kind of place has certainly been spoofed lots and lots of times. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that particular thing had ever been quite located, that sort of decorated with a particular nature-based detail.
But even in that sketch, they jump off the premise pretty quickly by having them randomly hurt each other.
Look at this. I just sold this bird right onto the pillow.
Oh, you missed his bag.
How are you doing? Watch your fingernails.
What about the bird?
Am I bleeding? Ma'am, am I bleeding?
No, you're fine. Stop looking at her. She's fine.
I know she's fine. I'm not.
Put a bird on it.
Oh, yeah. It becomes very quickly about those two hapless characters
exactly.
and how annoyed they are with each other.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it implies sort of a under-the-surface argument that they that they seem to have. What I sort of like about this and the way Mr. Cho and Upright Citizens Brigade, they do tend to bring back certain specific characters. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll see one character in the background of another scene, so it does have like a sense that this is all sort of one shared world, that they're sort of calling back, you know, these things. They feel tied together in a way where it's not just completely random sketches.
Right.
There is sort of a little bit of an arc there.
Right.
I will note that I saw them do what I thought at the time to be a pretty broad and not particularly funny parody of a Decemberists ad, an ad for the new Decemberists album, which turned out to be an ad for the new Decemberists album. So a little cognitive dissonance there.
Perfect.
Yeah. I have to say, as somebody who is generally, with the eternal exception of the Kids in the Hall, not a tremendous sketch comedy fan, I have not seen the whole show, but with Kat Siff's guidance, I have dug up some of the clips that they've been putting on the web, which presumably are the better clips. I've been kind of enjoying it. The Heavy Red clip is very, very funny.
I love that one.
Hey, did you guys read that thing in The New Yorker last month about how golf is an analogy for marriage?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did read that. Did you read the thing at McSweeney's? Mm. It was comparing CD tracks and album tracks. Did you read that?
Yeah. Did you read that thing in Mother Jones about eco chairs and eco ways to sit?
I did.
Did you read the New York Times?
Yes.
New York Observer?
Yes.
Washington Post?
Yes.
Wall Street Journal?
Of course I read it.
Did you read that steampunk article in Boing Boing?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read that skywriting over the Willamette River?
Yes. Did you read the fortune cookie?
Yes.
From last night?
Yes.
Did you read it?
Yes.
There were two.
Yes. Did you read that thing that guy wrote in the sand on the beach?
Yeah.
Did you read the Portland Mercury?
Yeah.
Did you read the Willamette Week?
Yeah.
Did you read the Seattle Stranger?
Beginning to end.
Did you read the SF Weekly?
I loved it.
The Harvard Lampoon?
Well written.
Did you read Mad Magazine?
I did not like the end of it.
Did you read the Bible?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Did you read it?
Finger writing on the window?
You did? Because I did.
Just the way that sketch uses, you know, language in a way that changes it up.
And rhythm, too. I think the show's, this show is, in some ways, and probably more so, much more so than live sketch comedy shows could ever be, it's about rhythm.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, agreed.
Yeah.
Well, I think we all recommend taking a look at it if you enjoy your hipster humor.
Yeah.
And your freegan jokes, as we said. And thank you to Mike, as always, for sitting in with us and making it possible for us to operate a conversation without Stephen.
That's right. And my voice didn't crack as much this time.
Thank you so much.
More Katziff.
Yeah. More Katziff.
And we will now allow Stephen back to his seat.
I like Portlandia, and everybody should watch Portlandia.
Oh. Because
it has my friend in it.
Quiet. Shut it.
And of course, as we always do, we thought we would wrap up this week with a round of What's Making You Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I saw Social Network over the weekend, and that's not what's making me happy per se, because I did feel the same sort of level of ambivalence I've been feeling toward Latter-day Sorkin. He's just a writer who squats by your side and kind of pokes you in the ribs to kind of tell you what you should think about these characters.
Yes, he does.
That gets a little annoying. And I'm contrasting that to another movie I saw recently called Dogtooth, which I do hope we get to talk about on this podcast because, wow.
It nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign
Film,
right?
It's from Greece. And it does the exact opposite of that to such an extent that sort of blankness becomes kind of the point of the film in a very interesting way. What I was drawn to in the film was a performance by the guy who played Eduardo. Eduardo is the CFO, and his job in the film is to be the put-upon guy, the guy overmatched by life, the guy screwed over. That part could really come off as really whiny, but it doesn't, because the actor is just soulful. He really makes you feel an empathy for him. And I know that I was being manipulated by the film to feeling this empathy, but I felt it nonetheless. I go on the IMDb after the movie's over, and of course, as everybody knows, except for me, that's Andrew Garfield, who is on deck to play the Amazing Spider-Man in the upcoming film. So let's break this down. What do you need to play Peter Parker? You need an ability to seem put upon and overmatched by life. You need empathy, because if there's any character in all of comics who seems more whiny than Peter Parker, I don't know it. It's the reason I didn't like Spider-Man when I was a kid, because I just thought he was ungrateful for all these cool powers he had. And finally, you need to look like a dweeb. Checkmate. I mean, this guy has a certain dweebishness to him. So I liked 2.1 of Raimi's films, Raimi's Spider-Man films, but there's something about Tobey Maguire where the part always seemed like a big goof to him. You knew that as soon as the camera stopped rolling, he was off to Chateau Marmotte and to a VIP room. He didn't fit the part. I think this guy's going to do a great job, and that's what's making me happy.
That's wonderful. Andrew Garfield as the Amazing Spider-Man.
And he is good in that movie.
He is.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, there are actually a couple of things making me happy in the realm of the movies. One of them is the number 150. That is the number of Criterion Collection movies that were released onto Hulu, specifically onto Hulu Plus this week. Mm-hmm. When I looked at the Criterion page today, the featured films were Breathless, The 400 Blows, Guillermo del Toro's Kronos, and The Red Balloon. That number, 150, is going up to 800 mm-hmm. by the end of the year, they say. The bad news, it's U.S. only for now, and as the contracts with Netflix expire, those movies will disappear from Netflix. So this won't make everybody happy, but if you've been thinking about Hulu and whether you want to subscribe to Hulu Plus, this may be the thing that tips it in your favor, especially if you're a real cinephile. Number two, ensemble comedy, specifically the film Cedar Rapids, which has gotten sort of good reviews, but hasn't made a gigantic splash. It is in its second week of release. It's still only playing in between 15 and 20 cities. If it's playing in yours, you could do worse things with your time this week. Ed Helms, John C. Reilly, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., especially Anne Heche as this sort of sad but vivacious character. She's one of these lively women with a certain sadness behind her eyes. Roger Ebert called the film a sweet comedy with a dirty mind, and I think that's pretty spot on. There are more detailed reviews at NPR.org and at the New York Times website if you want to read them, but go see it. The big thing this week that is movies related that I'm happy about, Newsies.
Newsies.
Not because it's a movie, but because it's coming to the stage.
So you are one of those people.
Absolutely.
You are one of those Newsies people.
Oh, yeah.
They're everywhere.
Are they?
Yes.
They are. Oh, yes, they are.
Everywhere you go, you run into people. All of a sudden, I thought of it as this completely inconsequential Disney musical that not very many people saw. But all of a sudden, in the last, 5 years, I've come to understand.
Yep. If you watched Newsies, you watched the hell out of it.
Talk to me about Newsies.
Well, this is it was the, 1992 live-action Disney musical starring a rather young Christian Bale as the leader of a gang of rowdy newsboys who decide to go on strike when Hearst and Pulitzer raised the wholesale prices of the newspapers that the little news hawking boys mm-hmm. have to sell to you on the street by shouting extra, extra at you. All right, so that's the basic plot line. The songs are by Alan Menken, Mr. Modern Day Disney Musical. Wrote
little
the songs.
Mermaid, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and he is the one who is sort of in charge of this new stage musical project, which is actually not that new. Here's the thing. The news this week that this is going to be a stage musical is not at all new. It's mm-hmm. been cooking since at a minimum late 2009, and maybe I've seen reports of but, rumors about it going back to 2003. But cooking doesn't always mean big deal, going to get a serious production. Mm-hmm. For a while, I think it was entirely unclear whether this was going to be something they just made and sold to schools for school productions, which would have made perfect sense given the sort of young people cult that has grown up around it. But the news this week is that it is opening the season next year at the Paper Mill Playhouse. And if you don't know what the Paper Mill Playhouse is, the reason this is important is it's a theater in New Jersey that's one of the non-Broadway go-tos for really first-class musical theater productions. It's been around since the 30s. It's got a reputation as a talent incubator, too. Anne Hathaway went to theater school there. Kristen Chenoweth made her professional debut there. Patrick Swayze danced in the chorus of The Music Man at the Paper Mill Playhouse back in the day. So the fact that this thing is going to lead off the season at this place means that Disney thinks there's some potential here.
And that they're taking it seriously.
They're taking it quite seriously.
That it's not just a let's rip a few more bucks out of the pockets of everybody who loved the movie, but they actually intend for it to be good.
Yeah, and if you read the item where this was sort of covered in the New York Times on Tuesday, Menken is talking about the savaging this film took, but he really seems invested in it in part because of how much his kids had invested in it. He talks about their arguing with him about which songs to cut. Somebody apparently invented a girl newsie for one of his daughters to play when she did a summer camp production, and then she turns around and pressures him to include that character in his revisions. Mm-hmm. So his enthusiasm for this thing comes off as quite real, not at all press releasey. That, I think, most about this story is what's making me happy.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Glad to hear it. Stephen Thompson.
You know, what is making me happy is also movie-related. Believe it or not, I saw a movie. Hmm. I saw another one, and I loved it. And
was it based on a book?
One more slow clap.
Another slow clap from the Catsif. This is a very Catsifian episode today. Hmm. In my efforts to see as many Oscar-nominated movies as possible, and because I had heard Glenn say nice things about it on this very podcast, I saw Exit Through the Gift Shop,
yay,
which is the Banksy documentary about street art, and it's done in a fairly inventive way that sort of forces you to sort of question everything that is being presented to you as to its veracity, but which also does give you sort of a sense of what goes into the various sort of iconography that you often see on the streets. You know, you see these Andre the Giant images everywhere, and you're like, what is the deal with that? Is that a band thing? Is that, what is that? And, oh, it's a street artist who puts that image everywhere, and there's mm-hmm. more than a million little images of Andre the Giant's face mm-hmm. all over, and you meet the guy who does it, and you get a sense of why. It's supposed to be a look at Banksy, and it ultimately winds up becoming a look at a different, less talented street artist, but, you know, that still gives you a sense of that world. Part of what I loved about it is it sort of subtly gave you this indication that not all street art is created equal, and that not all of this particular style of this art movement is created equal. And some of it is cute, some of it is funny, some of it is, you know, really thoughtful, and I would go so far as to say brilliant, and some of it is really, really hacky. Mm-hmm. Some of it is a hacky imitation of stuff that is brilliant, and some of it is graffiti. Mm-hmm. Some of it, you know, when they showcase, like, oh, this brilliant, you know, man draws this stupid cartoon character all over everything, and you just want to punch that guy in the ribs. You're like, if that guy spray painted that in my neighborhood, I would be so annoyed and just waiting for that to be painted over so mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to look at it anymore. Whereas some of these things, you practically want to, you know, when they knock down the building, save the wall mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that this stuff was painted on. So, you know, I loved having a look at a world that you sort of see, you know, when you're just flying by it on the train, or you see these things spray painted on buildings, and, you know, get a real look at why some of it is considered real art and why some of it shouldn't be. And also, of course, it has sort of more to say, obviously, about the nature of art collectors and you know, what art is worth. I highly, highly recommend it.
Excellent. Well, what is making me happy this week is very minor, very small. From time to time, I like it when I find a new TV show that I like, especially if it's something that somebody has been recommending to me that I have not gotten around to watching. And several of our listeners have made mention of The Good Wife to me, which is a CBS legal drama starring Juliana Margulies, who was on ER. And I like her, and also on this show is Josh Charles, who was one of the leads on Sports Night, which everyone knows I never shut up about Sports Night. So I like a legal drama. I like lawyer shows for the most part, as long as they're not dumb. So it made a certain amount of sense that I would like this show, but I have just never gotten around to it. As we spoke about with Parks and Recreation a few weeks ago, it's a real downside, I think, of the availability of DVDs and on demand, that people feel this obligation. If I didn't see it from the beginning, I should wait until I have time to watch 20 episodes in a row before I start watching it. Well, you know, I have enough of a sense of what has happened on this show. If you read a lot of blogs and things like that, you sort of know who the main people are and what has happened and what the big storylines are in broad strokes. I went back to 2 episodes ago and watched the last 2, because that's all they have available on CBS.com. And they're not on Hulu and they're not on some of the other things. I liked it a lot. It is a new show that all of a sudden I have a season and a half of to go back and watch that I know that I will like because I really like it. And now I have a new show that stars a really good actress who I like and has a really cute guy that I like. And I thought, what's not good about this? This is win-win-win. This is me and another lovely piece of popular television. So that's what's making me happy this
cool.
week. CBS's The Good Wife. And that brings us to the end of another Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can find Mike Katziff, our esteemed producer and panelist today, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can find Trey at Trey Graham, which is...
Trey with an even gram like the cracker.
It is really time for harmony.
If you don't like it when Stephen sings that, you can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, which is S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can also follow us, as I mentioned, on Facebook. Just by searching for Pop Culture Happy Hour on Facebook, we will keep you up to date on some of our favorite things. We talk about possible discussion topics, and we come and check in with you about links that we've found and things we thought you might be interested in.
It is a lovely community that is brewing.
It now. Is a mm-hmm. lovely community. Come and hang out with thousands of your fellow podcast listeners. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next week.